Welcome back to Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. In her book, Beloved Beasts, Fighting for Life in an Age of Extinction, Michelle Nyehaus tells the history of the conservation movement's efforts to save animal species from extinction, while also confronting the movement's history of racism and colonialism. And to do that, Michelle takes one pretty popular conservationist idea to task, the tragedy of the commons. I spoke to Michelle earlier this week about it. Here's our conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Great to be here, Sam.
So for those who don't know, what do we mean when we say the tragedy of the commons? What is that referring to?
Well, it's referring to a 1968 paper by an ecologist named Garrett Hardin. And it was an essay published in Science. It wasn't a... It wasn't based on any data. It was an argument. It was an essay. And Garrett Hardin's argument was that given free access to resources, a group of people would use up those resources until they were gone. And that the only way to prevent what he called the tragedy of the commons was either to privatize those resources for people to own them individually, or for there to be some kind of external intervention, some kind of government control of those resources. And for him, those were the only two options to prevent tragedy.
In the term the commons, what is that referring to?
Well, he took that term from a very ancient system in Europe of sharing pasture for livestock. And ironically, there have been systems in place in throughout Europe that have allowed people to share the commons more or less sustainably for hundreds and hundreds of years. So even when Garrett Hardin wrote The Tragedy of the Commons, the tragedy was not inevitable.
What can we say about Hardin himself and how his views were shaping both that idea of the tragedy of the commons, but also how he saw humans themselves?
He was an ecologist, and his central concern really throughout his career was human population growth. Hardin was writing at a time of real anxiety about population growth within the environmental movement, within the conservation movement. And this was often delivered with a real overtone of racism, you know, that the population growth was happening in poor countries. It was happening because people had this sort of insatiable appetite to breed. He worries that certain groups of people will reproduce faster than other groups. And in later in his life, he becomes much more explicit about this racism, talking about how multicultural societies are a disaster and talking about societies as lifeboats that would sink if they took on more people. And I think most people who refer to the tragedy of the commons aren't aware of Hardin's biases and Hardin's motivations in articulating the idea of the tragedy of the commons. And, you know, it is an attractive and in some ways useful idea because it does happen. It happens in people's daily lives all the time. But Hardin neglected to mention that the tragedy of the commons is anything but inevitable. It doesn't have to happen.
Okay, can you tell us about Eleanor Ostrom and her work?
Yeah. At the time that Garrett Hardin published his paper in 1968, Eleanor Ostrom was a graduate student in political science who was working in Los Angeles. And she was quite surprised by Garrett Hardin's gloomy conclusions about the capability of humans to manage their own resources, because she was observing the opposite in her study of water management in the Los Angeles basin. And she was watching water users who were, of course, you know, arguing over this very scarce resource in Los Angeles, work out a messy but workable system for sharing this resource. And they hadn't had to resort to privatization, and they hadn't had to resort to some external government control. They had managed to work it out among themselves. And so she thought, well, this argument that Garrett Hardin is making without any data, I should emphasize, that can't be right. I know from experience that humans are capable of this. And she set out to find and document other examples. Toward the end of her career, she identified what she called design principles for communities who managed to share their resources effectively. And those included things like good boundaries. You know, they had to define their resources well. They had to have a system of an escalating system of punishments for people who cheated on the system. They had to have good relationships with other levels of authority, whether those were household heads or whether they were larger scales of authority like states and national governments. But she always emphasized that there were no, what she called, no panaceas. So when she laid out her general design principles, as she called them, they were always delivered with a warning that these are not rules. These are common features that I've noticed as I've looked at these systems, but each system has to be tailored in a very particular way.
I wonder, do you have any favorite examples of places that you think show resources that are being managed particularly well?
Well, when I was researching my book, I had a chance to go to Namibia and witness their community conservation system in action. And that's been in place now for 30 years or so. And it draws on some very longstanding traditional institutions that were present before colonization in southern Africa. But it also draws on Eleanor Ostrom's principles that were used in reviving those systems in the 80s. So in Namibia, the system is that each community organizes what's called a conservancy, and they elect local people to lead their conservancy for a certain amount of time. And then local people participate in game surveys, so they help to set the quotas of each animal that is hunted. And they can then hunt the animals they need to survive, that they need for sustenance for their families. And then they also hire game guards from the community, usually, to patrol the area for poachers. And that's often a very effective way of warding off poachers, because the local people know the area so well, and they have such good relationships with people in the community that they have eyes and ears on the ground, and they can, you know, often intervene before someone even attempts to poach an elephant or a rhino. They can make sure that the populations of wildlife are healthy enough to allow continued low levels of hunting for the long term. And, you know, when we talk about hunting, we're talking about very occasional hunting of large charismatic animals, but mostly hunting of antelope and other, sort of the equivalent of our deer and elk here in North America.
I'd love to dwell just for a moment on this idea of big game hunting being a tool for conservation, because I think, you know, when you see the trophy photo of a white hunter having shot, you know, whatever it may be, say a rhino, say a lion, it seems like quintessentially colonialism, but there's another way to see that photo.
Yeah, there is another way to see that photo. And I have the same gut reaction that I think most people who care about conservation in North America do, you know, when I see the photo of someone, you know, victoriously hoisting a dead animal over their head, and it's, you know, invariably a white person, you know, hoisting an animal that's native to Africa. It's viscerally appalling. But I think that there is another way to look at that. And when you speak to people in Africa who are involved with community-led conservation, they will say, look, yes, there are ways and places in which trophy hunting is abused, in which it is a exploitation of both wildlife and people. But in certain cases, when it's well controlled, it can be a way of eliminating individual problematic animals and giving back to conservation. So just one example from Namibia, in recent years, a trophy hunter paid the equivalent of $400,000 to hunt an older male rhino who was actually interfering with the ability of younger rhinos in the area to mate. It had become aggressive and was causing problems within the herd. And so that $400,000 was, you know, many times what any individual community conservancy might make in a year. And that money went into a national fund for conservation. And then arguably the rhino population was made healthier. It was able to reproduce more because this older male was killed. So people who are involved in community-led conservation would point to an example like that and say, look, you know, this is a way of exploiting colonial nostalgia. You know, if someone wants to come from North America or Europe and kind of, you know, play the big game hunter and give us $400,000 for it that we can then use for conservation, we'll take that deal. And if it's a situation where an individual animal can be taken out of the population and actually benefit that population, that's going to work out well, both for people and for the vulnerable wildlife that we are trying to do right by. And so, again, I think I would point back to Eleanor Ostrom, who says there are no panaceas. Certainly, trophy hunting is not a solution that anyone would recommend applying everywhere and anywhere, but used in this very precise, targeted way, it can be a powerful tool.
So this critique of the tragedy of the commons has been around for quite a while now, and occasionally it sort of like blurps out into the public enough that I have been aware of it for about 10 years. And So now whenever anyone says, oh, you know, the tragedy of the commons, I just want to like flip a table and like throw my hands in the air and just, you know, it's like, it's only, you know, commons are mismanaged when we allow them to be mismanaged, you know? And I guess I want to know, like, is there a way that we can, you know, help to repackage Eleanor Ostrom's ideas into a snappy, you know, can we write Eleanor's law or Ostrom's law that you know, so that it can counteract this really outdated idea?
I know. It is so frustrating. And people have tried. People have said it's not a tragedy. It's more like a comedy because you don't know the outcome of a comedy. Well, you do know the outcome of a tragedy. It's the miracle of the commons. But, I think Eleanor Ostrom, rightly so, but perhaps to her own disadvantage, resisted these kind of bumper sticker summaries of her own work by always saying there are no panaceas, there's no one solution, it's very complicated. I mean, I think the best and most accurate answer, perhaps, that there is to the tragedy of the commons is to say it's complicated.
Michelle, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Sam. Great to be here. I'm glad you're fired up about the tragedy of the commons.
Oh, it drives me nuts.
I know. It drives me nuts, too.
That was Michelle Nyhaus. She's the author of Beloved Beasts, Fighting for Life in an Age of Extinction. You can find her essay, The Miracle of the Commons, at aeon.co. That's aeon.co. This episode was produced by Justine Paradise, Felix Poon, Taylor Quimby, and me, Sam Evans Brown. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Music in this episode by Chris Zabriskie and Blue Dot Sessions. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a member-supported podcast and a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.